My name's Curtis Taylor. I'm actually the grad student, and Craig Hsu is my advisor, and I'm presenting the work along with Nathaniel Paul of converting, trying to convert an IP address into a street address. So there are many motivating examples, and with those examples, we have a lot of goals that we try to achieve with this work. I'm going to talk about how the current approaches fell to do this quickly and accurately enough, and then I'll go into our approach and specifically how we used covert wireless signals in helping to locate a client that's using a wireless network. I'll talk about two experiments, one very briefly and one that was a little more in-depth that's interesting. There are countermeasures to this approach, obviously, as to most approaches, there are countermeasures, and I'll mention those and then wrap up and talk about where I'm going in the future. So the motivation for it are there are people online that do things that they shouldn't. So the prime example are child predators. They get online, do things, and usually they get off very quickly. So you need to be able to, you know, pinpoint their location and get them off the internet as fast as you can. Or another example would be online assailants. But the current work isn't fast enough or accurate enough, for example, for law enforcement purposes and other processes like going through the ISP and subpoena for their address. It's a slow process and definitely not quick enough. And our approach of using wireless networks, it's kind of backed by recent studies that show that between 61 and 80% of homes are using wireless networks now. So run through of our goals for the research. Definitely we wanted fast localization, preferably within an hour. It also needs to be very precise, down to a street address at the very least. We want to avoid having any special powers, such as being law enforcement or having to go through the ISP. It needs to be a universally applicable approach. So if somebody's using their laptop and they switch over to a tablet or a smartphone, the approach still needs to be able to work. And we want to only use commodity hardware and software so that you don't have to spend a lot of money in order to achieve what we're going for. And it should be minimally invasive or noticeable, so whoever the target is shouldn't know that the approach is being ran on them and they're trying to be located. So we're going after everybody but the most sophisticated of targets. So there are two main current approaches that are in this area. One by Wang et al. They used latency measures in order to ping a target's location, and based on the latency, they were able to narrow down where the target was. The problem with this is that gets you, for example, based on a census or a city near, it's between New York and New Jersey, I believe, that could still be up to around 33,000 people, and that's, you know, obviously not good enough. And kind of a downside of the approach is it does depend on having these landmarks. So you have to have more landmarks to get better accuracy. Another area of research by Chen et al., it's kind of the other side of the spectrum. You have Wang et al. That goes from the global IP space kind of down to a general area. And then you have Chen et al., and what that work was is say you have a street address, say a hotel, you need to know who inside that hotel that's more than likely located behind a NAT box is committing the activity on the global IP address. So it's mapping the global IP address to the user behind it that's running on NAT. So narrowing down and pinpointing the individual. There are other approaches such as based on IP prefix. For example, my university, if you see its IP prefix, you know exactly where I am, and you can narrow down the geographical location pretty quickly. But it's not really reliable. You have people that go online and they'll war drive and post stuff that they saw online, maybe on unencrypted networks, but it's not really formal and, like I said, not reliable. So what our approach tries to do is bridge the gap between Wang's work and Chen's work. So you're getting within, we're trying to get you within the 690 meter radius down to the street address where you could maybe further apply Chen's approach if necessary. We're going to assume that we get within Wang's localization of 690 meters, so that's going to be the starting radius for our approach. There are three components that you should know about. The first two, the observer and the signaler, and then the target. The target's pretty obvious, that's the person you're going after. The signaler is who's gonna send the communication to the target, and then the observer is gonna be the person who's gonna physically traverse a region looking for the wireless signals that are sent by the signaler. The code name's Marco Polo. Some of you may know this childhood game. You have somebody who's chosen as it. They're blind, and they yell out Marco, and the other people that are playing the game yell out Polo, and they try to locate him. So that's kind of what we're doing. We're having a signaler send a little beacon, and the observer try to find it. So here's a layout of the approach. We'll see that we have the two landmarks at the top. That is representative of Wang's approach, trying to use those landmarks to get us within the outer radius. We have the signaler, which is a special machine that's going to send the packet to the target's wireless router. The wireless router is then going to broadcast the packet within some radius to the target's machine, and we have a physical observer who's going around monitoring the spectrum looking for those packets. Now, this would be easy if encryption wasn't out there. So if nobody encrypted anything, you could just send a packet to the target that says, here I am, come find me, and you could just monitor for wireless packets data. Well, obviously that's not the case, so we need a different approach to this. So the way we went after it was using fields that weren't encrypted, specifically the packet size. You can monitor for wireless packets and you can always look at the wireless packet size. So we use that in being our beacon, and just based on some quick experimentation, we found some relatively uncommon packet sizes to be around 750 to 1500 bytes. So that's going to be the range in which we generate packets to send. So what the signaler does is he generates a long series of packet sizes randomly and associates each packet size with a timestamp. So this allows for you to build up a database, and then what's going to happen is we're going to allow that database to be shared between our observer and our signaler so that as the process of searching is going on, they don't have to have an active connection communicating this database back and forth. So the first thing is, well, how do you go about starting to set up this connection? Well, the two areas I'm going to talk about is if you have an access point, like a lot of major universities, most of the time they'll just broadcast a packet without actually having seen a mapping set up. So if you send a packet to my IP address, that access point nearest me is just going to broadcast it. So that's pretty straightforward. But the other more common case, somebody on a home network, they're probably going to be sitting behind NAT. So the way you can get this connection initially established, a good example would be the FBI. They set up honeypots, they promise to offer whatever illicit content that the target's looking for. That'll set up the initial connection, put the NAT mapping in place that we need. There are other things such as peer-to-peer, NAT traversal techniques, or hidden iframes, as many have mentioned throughout the presentations. So once that's set up, we're now talking about bringing our approach into play. One thing that's very important is that if they're behind a NAT device and we send an application to them and it's broadcast, we don't want to notify any applications that the packet's being broadcast to them. So if an application saw a packet that it didn't expect, it may try to close the connection, send fin flags, and try to kill the connection off. So we don't want to alarm them. So the way we were able to get around this is by sending out-of-band packets, specifically using out-of-window TCP packets. So once the NAT mapping is already set up, we can just continue to use this mapping and send packets that are out-of-window. And the beauty part about this is that the target's kernel is just going to drop these because they're out-of-window and they're not going to be passed up to the application layer. This also allows for a benefit for the attacker to where it doesn't matter what application the target's using, whether he's running a web server or some other type of service. As long as he's using TCP, it doesn't matter, he can still send these packets. So what's happening is that we now have how we initially set up this connection and how we're going to send the packets with that TCP packets out of window, but one concern you're going to have is, well, what if they close their connection? We have to maintain this connection during the duration of the actual locating process. So we looked at several different models of consumer grade routers. We found that all of them are going to forward the out of window packets to the client and they're just going to be dropped by the OS. But more interestingly, even after the client kills the connection, so if you're connected to a web server, for instance, and we're starting this process, even after you kill your web browser, we're still going to be able to forward you packets after the fact because that NAT mapping has been set up. And that's beautiful for us. So you come in quickly and you get out and we're still going to be able to send you stuff. We did find one example one out of the five routers did stop forwarding packets. And it's interesting to point out that by doing this immediately, it's actually violating two RFCs that state that depending on a couple of different vendors have different time sets, but I think it's around 4 minutes, they say, you should leave the NAT mapping active. So it allows for all retransmissions and any data that hasn't been transmitted to be transmitted after the connection's been closed. So to test our approach, we did two experiments. The first I'm not really going to talk about. It was in an apartment setting, so I set this up in my apartment, and I walked down the street seeing if I could find which building it was located in and if I could pick out which floor it was in based on the signal strength that I was receiving. So the key point to that was that I had over 20 wireless networks around me, and I had zero false positives in that experiment, and I was able to exactly locate where the target was, aka my router. The other more interesting experiment was in a residential neighborhood, and the way this worked is the target, who at the time was my advisor, and I did not know where he lived, he set up his home machine to connect to an HTTP server on campus, which the HTTP server being the signal in our approach, and he left his computer connected to the server during the duration of the experiment. So these packets are being broadcasted from the signaler on campus to his computer. He's doing nothing. The experiment total took around approximately 40 minutes to finish, and you'll see a little bit more about that in a second. But what I did was I had a laptop, and I had all the packets that were generated by the signaler and the timestamps associated with them shared, as I mentioned earlier, and I started actually driving around in my truck. So what I was given was the figure one on the left-hand side. I was given this with no street names, and none of the blue was there or the outlined region. Obviously, the target didn't tell me where he lived at the time. So all he gave me was an intersection down here and said, come find me. So with an old laptop running Linux and omnidirectional wireless antenna taped to my window, I drove around looking for where he was located. The blue path is the actual path that I traversed in my truck. And you'll notice an outline region in figure one, which is what's blown up in figure two. This shows the true positives and the false positives that I found during the experiment. I noticed four, you'll see down at the very bottom, four false positives. They were very brief, and I, based on previous experiments, I knew that this wasn't the location of them, so I was able to move on from that spot quickly. So there are four of those, and you'll notice at the top in the green are the true positives, and I have easily over 1,000. So I was definitely able to narrow down that this was the region in which the target was located in, but I didn't have any specialized equipment, so I wasn't able to narrow it down further. There happened to be three houses in this area that I wasn't able to choose between. So some of the outcomes was obviously, as I just mentioned, I narrowed it down to three houses, but the upsetting part was that because my advisor didn't want to bias the experiment, he left his router exactly in the location it was before we started this research, and he had just moved into a new house. And it happened to be mounted behind a TV next to a fireplace facing out the back window into an alley. So it kind of gave me a false impression of where it was because the signals were going, they were going right by a house that wasn't his. So some important notes to make were that we didn't use any directional antennas, and we didn't bring into the calculation the RSSI values, so we didn't try to use signal strengths to determine how close we were. This definitely leaves potential for better results, though. So some obvious countermeasures to the approach would be to hardwire or use a proxy server. So as I stated earlier, you have 61 to 80% of people in a home setting using a wireless router. You're not going to go to a hardwire either because you're lazy or because it's just too much of an inconvenience. And then the proxy server, you could definitely hook up to the Tor network or something and get away with this. Another thing that could be done is if it's an advanced target, they could do things at the router to try to have some obfuscation. So since we're using packet sizes to give away the network, they could do some padding where they uniformly pad every single packet to be the same size. But this doesn't protect against another approach we looked at that I haven't talked about, which uses burst. So if you have a network that's not really active, then you could have your signaler sending burst of packets at specific times synced with your observer, and you would be able to tell that that person, based on the burst of wireless signals, was the target. They could also go about having some anomaly detection on the router, so if the router starts noticing a bunch of out-of-window packets come in, instead of forwarding them on, it could raise an alert and notify the target. So the implications to this are that maybe you're not as anonymous as you once thought you were on the internet. So if you connect into my web server, maybe it's the fact that I can use your IP address to come find you. And anyone can do this. Like I said, I used an old laptop and just a wireless antenna that was taped to my window. So it means, you know, anyone has the capability to do this right now. I'm not in any way, shape, or form a judge or a lawyer, but there was a ruling quite recently that a federal judge in Illinois said that because unencrypted data was readily available to the general public, that it fell legal under an exception of the Wiretap Act. So based on the headers being unencrypted, it may, you know, it falls into that gray area. So as a quick summary, we're able to quickly locate a wireless target. So I was able to locate my advisors within three houses. I was able to locate my advisor's house rather quickly, 40 minutes. We had the three components: the signaler, who sends the specially crafted packet to the target, and the observer, who's driving around physically traversing the area monitoring for packets. It's extremely cost effective. We use only open source software and hardware that we already had. Works even on encrypted networks, because all we're doing is monitoring for packet sizes and the packet header. We called this approach, or we said that we used covert wireless signals in this case, because we were using the out-of-window TCP packets. And it worked in different environments. So we had the apartment setting where there were many, many wireless signals, and I was still able to narrow down exactly where the target was located. And it also worked in a residential neighborhood where you have houses more spread out, less signals. And it definitely raises privacy concerns when you talk about being able to geographically locate someone. In the future, where we're hoping to go, definitely run more experiments and more settings, get some more interesting results, hopefully use some specialized equipment, so bi-directional antenna, be able to triangulate somebody's exact location, and maybe transition this into a more practical setting so that it can actually be used. Questions?
Okay, we have time for a few questions.
We'll say it's similar to the London, I think this is the London Olympics, where they were trying to stop rogue wireless networks that were popped up. So they had a guy with a little backpack and a directional antenna going around, pointing it, trying to find the source, similar to what we're doing.
Okay, so I have a couple questions.
Sure.
So have you seen interest from law enforcement in using this technique yet? Or, because it sounds pretty useful.
I've been advised to tread carefully in this area. I would say that you'll have to talk to my advisor on that, as I am not completely sure.
No, fair enough. One more question. Have you experimented with denser environments? So I don't recall if you said how dense the apartment building experiment was, but do you have a feeling for, you know, how dense you could go and still have good results?
So the density wasn't, so there weren't, density based on people, there weren't that many people. There were maybe 50 people in the area around which I was searching. The apartment building I was in had, it has 12 people housed in it. But what I thought was most important about that was that I monitored around 20 different wireless networks that were going on. So that means that there were a lot of different packets going on that were unrelated, and I saw very few false positives in those cases. So when I did see a packet, it was more or less always a true positive.
So you're able to deal with a decent amount of noise.
Right.
Great. Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, if there aren't any more questions, let's thank the speaker.